All right. As usual, I'd like to start by taking your comments on the subject of the chapter, after which I've got the same material organized in a somewhat different way that I can discuss if you run out of things you want to talk about. So, basic issue that we hopefully can use the stuff we've looked at from legal systems to think about, but also what you know about our own legal system, is the incentive to prosecute people for crimes. And that, from my standpoint, is partly the question of what's the right level of incentive, but also how can you set up the system which makes it more likely that you will prosecute guilty people and less likely you will prosecute innocent people. Those are both, it seems to be, important questions. A number of my colleagues here, of course, have been involved in the Innocence Project and things of that sort. And one of the things that struck me a long time ago is that nobody really knows what the false positive rate in the criminal justice system is. Right? A false positive is convicting someone who's innocent, as opposed to a false negative, which is acquitting someone who's guilty. And I think people's beliefs about the system depend a whole lot on that unknown number. That if your view is you almost never convict innocent people, then you say, well, maybe the death penalty makes sense, that people have done a terrible thing. Yes, one time in a million you'll execute an innocent person. That's too bad, but that's the price you're willing to pay. If you think, nah, you know, 10%, 15% of the people who are convicted, maybe they're convicted on plea bargains because they're threatened with something much worse if they don't. At that point, you start getting much more skeptical about the system and much more worried about a lot of issues of how you might improve it or whether you should have shorter sentences or a lot of other things. And as I say, nobody knows. I had a project I've tried for, over the years to get somebody more confident to do it than me to, interested in, which was to try to use the results of DNA testing coming in to get at least a rough measure. So that my original idea is you find some friendly jurisdiction that's willing to let you do research. And you then locate everybody who's imprisoned who, for whom there is surviving tissue evidence that would probably acquit them if they're innocent. And you then say, all right, take all of them if you can afford it, or a random selection of them, test the tissue evidence, what percentage are innocent. And because, of course, the trouble of the Innocence Project from this standpoint is that they are obviously trying to select people who they think there's good reason to think is innocent. That's a highly non-random sample. And given that we are convicting huge numbers of people each year, the fact that there are 10 or 20 or 50 or 100 who are innocent doesn't really tell us very much, even though the individual cases are upsetting. So that's why I'd like to do it. Now, my method isn't perfect either, because, of course, cases that leave tissue evidence are not a random sample either, but it's a lot closer to a random sample. And the closest I've seen, I read it, I don't know if it was ever published, but I read at least a draft of something somebody had read, and what he had, his assumption, and I don't know if he had data to support it or not, was that rape murder cases, which were especially likely to leave tissue evidence, by now they had after the fact tested all of the evidence. Now, I'm not really sure he's right about that. And he then said, well, all right, how many such convictions were there over the period before DNA testing was available for the trial? How many of those people turned out to be innocent? And I think his estimate was a false positive rate of 2 or 3%, as I remember. But I would like to see a sort of a more systematic attempt to do that project. But I've tried to get personal interest, and I'm not really competent to do that sort of work. I don't have all the contacts. But it would be very interesting to know. I'll be mentioning later a piece I did with Steve Schulhofer when I was in Chicago, and my impression in discussions of that was that a good deal of people's reactions hinged on whether they really believed that a significant number of innocent people were being convicted or not. I'll get back to that later. But anyway, so what comment did you have reading the chapter or thinking about the issue?
Yes. Following up on that comment right now, you talked about the plea bargaining system and how that leads to false convictions. And I was wondering if you have any comments on how that would be different if we had compulsory prosecution like we do in Germany.
Where there was no plea bargaining.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it'd be much more expensive, assuming we tried to prosecute as many people. That's the obvious difference. It's not clear whether that is one of the points I make in one of my books a long time ago is that people attack plea bargaining on the theory that it's soft on criminals, that less people get off lightly. And it looks like a good argument. You say, look, why would you accept the plea unless it was a better deal? But that's holding constant prosecutorial resources available to prosecute. And if you imagine that nobody plea bargained, now with the same resources, the prosecutor would be spread much thinner, and therefore it might well be that without plea bargaining, you would on average get lighter sentences. That in this system, when the prosecutor goes to the defendant knows everybody else is copying a plea, so he can focus on me if I don't, so I've got a high chance of getting convicted. So that means that either you would have, I think, a sizably lower conviction rate, or you'd have to spend much more on the cost of trials, basically. But beyond that, I don't know. I mean, the disturbing thing, obviously, is that in a situation where the prosecution can charge you with a whole bunch of related offenses totaling, 500 years in prison or something, it's very tempting to say, when they say, but we'll let you out for time served if you'll just confess and plead it guilty to one, obviously there are incentives to do that. And that may well mean that a lot of people are convicted of crimes they didn't commit. I don't know.
We think that there was a story in the article about how China's government just reported that they mine the organs of their convicts.
Yes.
So if a convict is on death row, sometimes you can kill them on the way to the hospital to mine their organs.
Yes.
And I guess it made me think of incentives to convict, to use the prisoner.
Yes.
Way,
yes,
to
that's.
Use them as a
yep.
army or use them as a.
I have a journal article which is on that subject. It's an old article, and it's called "Why Not Hang Them All: The Inefficiency of Efficient Punishment." And the argument is that there are a lot of ways you could imagine changing how we punish people, which, if you just look at the punishment, are more efficient, in the sense that executing somebody, he loses a life and nobody gets anything. Organs forfeit, he loses a life, and maybe you save several lives, depending on the case. Imprison someone is even worse than execution, because not only does he lose his freedom, but somebody else has to pay for the prison. So I don't know if I discussed it in this class, but I've in the article and also somewhere in my book Law's Order, I have this sort of proposal for improving the system. Did I come on that through with you? The one where you replace all prisoners, all sentences of imprisonment with probabilistic execution. So the argument goes as far. Did I go? Yeah.
I think you talked about it.
I find it hard to keep straight what I talk to in different classes. It's the same ideas show up in lots of different places. So, but then you can also, but the version the Chinese are doing is actually a series of Larry Niven science fiction stories, and he raises exactly that point that in the stories. You realize at the end that what's happened is they've greatly expanded the range of capital offenses because there's a shortage of organs, and so you always have the argument, maybe three dangerous driving convictions shouldn't be capital offense, but would you rather have several people die from lack of organs for transplant than execute one person who has, after all, risked other people's lives by how he drives? And that's sort of the implicit argument in that.
And the other issue with the Chinese system is they don't have the same level of appeal that we have. And so
yes. Well, what started me thinking on this a long time ago was an online argument, because I was proposing a version of criminal law in which any crime had a sentence of the form X dollars or Y years. And you had the option, aside from you didn't have the money to pay off X dollars, you could either spend Y years in a state prison, or you could go to a private prison that was a factory, and they would make an offer saying, we will pay off your fine at so much per year if you work for us, and here's what it looks like, here's how much you have to work. If you don't like it, you can go to the state prison, so they don't have leverage over you in that sense. And I was arguing that was an improved system you get. And somebody's response in an online discussion was, yes, the colonial powers in Africa had that idea. When they wanted a road built, they found some excuse to arrest a bunch of the locals and then sentence them to work on the road gang. And that, it seemed to me, was a legitimate point. And that one of the problems with a lot of economic analysis of law is that it's applying the approach to the criminals and the victims, but not to the enforcement apparatus. And you want to think, and one of the things we're doing in a sense in this course, think about the incentives of the people who are making and enforcing the laws and figure out whether the rule that might be a good rule from the other side might be a bad rule for them. And that's essentially that's what you have to worry about. Yeah.
Okay.
following up on that, I thought there was a little bit of a contradiction to what you wrote last week and wrote this week while in Imperial China.
Yes.
How you talked about last week that torturing a witness that was innocent defendant didn't impose a cost on the doing torturing. And this week...
Impose a cost on the witness, not on people doing the torturing.
Right. Impose the cost on the witness, not on people doing the torturing. And then this week you talked about how... there were a number of cases cited about innocent defendants who confessed under torture but then were saved by the wise official.
Yes.
So the system did have a cost. It was the opportunity cost of the wise official's time being wasted and the opportunity cost of the people conducting the torture.
Putting it differently, it had a cost, but it's not clear if it's a cost to the people doing the torturing. It had the cost of making possible some convictions of innocent people, which argue would make the system work worse. Now, whether the Chinese believe that made it work worse, it's sort of, I mean, those stories imply they do, but you don't really know. The people who are running the empire may have said, well, as long as people believe we got the right guy, it'll have the right effect. I don't know. But yeah, no, these are from two different sources, I should say. That the first comment was really based on the discussion of the book you're going to be reading, and the second was from the von Gulick translation of a collection of sort of exemplary stories for, so you don't know how true they are, but they're sort of stories that are supposed to, of cases that are supposed to sort of help people who are going to be magistrates figure out how to do their job, kind of thing. I suppose what you're saying is true. I'm not sure it's a very large cost, but you would think more generally of the cost where they don't catch it, and therefore they get the wrong person.
Well, I'm thinking the wise official probably has some type of recourse some way over those.
He might.
Torture. I mean, I don't think he'd appreciate his having these frivolous cases come before him.
Well, he might. It's an opportunity to show how clever he is, after all.
There was a cost to the official torture, as I mentioned. Magula points out if the person
if they dies,
the torture, then the official himself suffers death.
But that's if he dies. But you can do a lot of things short of killing people.
But the eggshell defendant, if you inflict several blows on
We were talking about witnesses. We were talking about witnesses, actually, not defendants. But, that is, torturing defendants, you can argue, well, look, if most of the defendants are guilty, then that's just part of the punishment. Of course, some of them aren't. But the witness, there's no particular reason to think he's guilty because it's part of it. I mean, this goes back to the whole business of torturing slaves in Greece and Rome, which also seems rather weird to us, and yet they took for granted. Other sort of responses, comments? Yeah.
You're talking about private deterrence as how private deterrence might work, and that it strikes the right efficient balance.
Maybe. I mean, I hedge that in a number of ways, but yeah.
But I was wondering about possible market failure in that situation. Because the person who's victimized, if there are relatively few criminals, will simply say, at least envision him saying, well, it's unlikely that I'll be victimized again, so I shouldn't be prosecuted.
But that's why they have the associations with prosecution of felons in 18th century England, precisely to solve that problem. That what you want to do is to pre-commit. You say, after I am robbed, I wouldn't prosecute. Before I'm robbed, I want to set things up so I will prosecute. Because then I won't be robbed with any luck, because the guys who are going to rob me are going to know I've set it up that way.
Okay. So it seems like that's a necessary precondition.
Unless you're a repeat victim. Unless you're somebody who's likely to be a victim often enough to make a reputation. That's the point I tried to make in the 18th century article. That's right.
Then the same question that I had was... reputational enforcement.
Yes.
And what did he say? I can't find the exact wording, but it seems to depend. Reputational enforcement seems to depend on third parties having all the information.
Having enough information to be reasonably confident that you're guilty, that's right.
Or that you're not guilty.
Or that you're not guilty.
Right. I was wondering if you have any proposed solutions for making that information more readily available to third parties.
Sure.
Because one solution to me might be like having a chip in you, which would tell a third party
that is
what conflicts you've been in? But that seems like a long way.
Yeah, but let me give you two answers. The science fiction, but not as extreme as your version. One of the subjects I discussed in my other seminar is David Brin's book, The Transparent Society, where he's looking at what happens as there are more and more video cameras around. And if you combine a lot of surveillance cameras with face recognition software and databases, you could have a world where everything that happens in public places is searchable and findable. And that would then get to something more like what you're describing. But the other thing is that the context, I think, in which arbitration works best is where you have parties agree to the arbitrator in advance, and then the arbitrator is generating the information. So imagine a case where you and I sign a contract, we're maybe in the same industry dealing with each other, and the contract specifies some arbitration system maybe within the industry to settle our disputes. So we have a dispute, we go to the arbitrator. The arbitrator rules that I owe you $10,000. Imagine that this is not in a context where the arbitration is enforceable in the courts. In the U.S. at the moment it often is, but it hasn't always been, and isn't always in all contexts. So the arbitrator has no way of making me pay you $10,000. He can, however, inform anybody else who's curious that that was his verdict. So now they have a low-cost way of figuring out that since I didn't pay, I'm the bad guy. And that's a mechanism. So the I would argue that a way of looking at the institution of private arbitration is precisely a way of lowering information costs and interests of third parties. And the critical thing is that we've agreed on the arbitrator in advance, so the third party doesn't have to check out the arbitrator. Maybe one of us was really stupid, but he probably doesn't want to deal with stupid people either. But the presumption, if we know what we're doing, is that we agreed with the arbitrator because he was a fair arbitrator, and therefore his verdict can be relied on. And I've discussed elsewhere in the context of online commerce, fairly easy ways of using digital signatures, basically, as a way of getting the equivalent of that for even anonymous transactions.
Yeah, what I really like about online transactions, at least in this regard, is the ease with which you can access someone's reputational history. And reading this article made me really want for
a real-world way.
A real-world way. Yep. Yes.
I think in some ways our present legal system tries to prevent that because there are various cases in which records are supposed to be expunged. And I'm not even sure, am I allowed to ask you whether you've declared bankruptcy when I'm lending money, assuming it was more than 10 years ago or something?
I don't know.
I think there are restrictions of that sort, which I'm not sure make a lot of sense, but even aside from online, you can see that simply the existence of the Internet is making it at least easier to do. That I actually had an interesting case, I think, within the last year where I wanted my roof to replace, more or less. And so I contacted a number of firms that were in the business of doing that and spoke to their people. And one of the firms, the guy they sent over, seemed very competent, seemed like a nice fellow. But I did some online investigation. And it turned out that this was, I think, the third of a string of firms run by the same people with a very bad reputation, where it looked as though they were running a firm, cheating their customers, closing down that firm and starting another one. So I think the guy who we spoke to came back to talk to us, and I told him that, and I took the position that maybe he didn't know he was working for scam artists and might want to know. Whether he did, I have no idea, but I went with somebody else and was happy with the result. So that was a case in which for real space transactions, the existence of the Internet made it much easier than it would have been 20 years ago to try to get reputational information. And one of the things that I've noticed on the radio, which is sort of interesting on the other side of this, is there is apparently a webpage called reputation.com. And what they claim they're trying to do is to keep you from having a bad reputation that's undeserved. But there's nothing in their description of their activity, at least in the ad, that suggests that they're trying to figure out whether your bad reputation is deserved or not, that they're trying to do various things on the web. I don't know just what, but to try to maybe make attacks on you less visible, or maybe they're creating. One of the things, of course, you see when you do that, when you look at reviews of firms, is there are some reviews that you strongly suspect were written by the firm, that they're fake, and maybe that's what reputations.com is doing, is saying, here is something saying this company was terrible. Let's write a supposed post by another customer saying, no, that's not true. We had a much better experience. I don't know. But that's obviously a problem throughout. And eBay, as you may know, has got its own reputation mechanisms built in where if you buy something on eBay, you get a chance after the fact to put up a comment on your experience. And since when you buy something on eBay, eBay gets a cut of the price, that means that doing a very thorough job of either defaming the competition or making yourself look good is expensive, because you would have to have a bunch of bogus transactions in order to be allowed to put up those posts. But obviously you're going to worry about that. It'd be interesting, actually, if you could talk. I'm sure there are people at eBay whose profession is trying to make the reputational system work. I don't know how they do it, but given what they're doing, they obviously have thought about this issue. And, you know, how do you prevent... Now, one thing, of course, is that there are lots of sellers. It doesn't pay any seller to defame another seller, so they'll just go to someone else. So that would be a reason to trust these things less where there are only two or three people selling a particular kind of item.
Yeah, this reminds me of an article I read one time. A professor was responding to the notion that that we should remove a person. So the original proposition was that we should remove a person's past history because it engenders bias based on that history.
Uh-huh.
And the professor's response was, no, we should make that information available, because it's proven that people are less biased and prejudiced when they have full information about someone. When they don't have information, they rely on factors that we don't like, for instance, race. But when people have access to more information, they tend to be less biased.
Yeah. But a different way of putting it is that it isn't biased to not trust somebody who's cheated people in the past. It's rational.
Right. And so when people don't have that information, they rely on race or they rely on gender.
Yeah, that's what's referred to as statistical discrimination, which is not irrational if you don't have any better data. If you say, on average, men have more upper body strength than women. If I know nothing at all about you other than your gender, and I have a job which involves picking stuff up, I'd rather hire a man. But if I have better information, I can do better with that. That I think is right. I don't know, but I may have mentioned the story of my experience in Australia, which was, in a way, it wasn't on the same issue, and yet it really was, about the guy who'd been burned. I spent a summer in Canberra, Australia, and I was staying, it was basically sort of like a hotel or motel, which I think belonged to the university I was at, I don't remember, but one of the other people there who I sort of met in the equivalent of the bar of the hotel early on, at some point had been very badly burned, and his face just looked horrible, so that when I first saw him, I had to look away, in effect. And at some point, I got into a conversation with him. And once I talked to him for a while, the effect just disappeared. Because I was now seeing him as the personality I was interacting with, which happened to have this weird-looking face, rather than sort of the monster, which is what you appear to be when your face is all... I don't even remember what he looked like anymore. It was a long time ago. But I remember my reaction to it. It was sort of quite striking to see the degree. And I think the same thing is almost true. If you think about romantic interactions, that when you don't know a member of the opposite sex, your reaction is nice figure, pretty face, that sort of stuff. Once you know them, an awful lot of that disappears in both directions. That, you know, you can have somebody, well, yes, indeed, she'd look very nice in Playboy, but I don't want anything to do with her. Or alternatively, yeah, no, she's not particularly, you know, sexy looking, but boy, is she a wonderful person. You know, that's the person I want to spend the rest of my life with.
I've actually read an article that is close to that, but actually says something different. The fact that your perception of a person's physical appearance will change after you know their personality.
Yes.
So it's not that you care less about their physical appearance.
Yes.
So your perception of their physical appearance alters more into your perception of their...
I have a story about that which isn't quite the same, but it's pretty striking, and that is one of my hobbies is historical recreation, Society for Creative Anachronism. And there used to be a very active Usenet news group. I don't know how many of you know what Usenet news is, but it's not all that active nowadays because it's been largely replaced by web forums. But basically, it was an online, very large collection of what looked like bulletin boards, but was in fact decentralized. It wasn't located anywhere. Phone machines sending messages back and forth. It's still there. It's just not as active as it used to be. Specialized in different things. So it was sort of a conversation among a group of people who were all interested in subject X. And one of them was SCA, this medieval organization. And the organization was spread all over this country and Canada and some people outside of the country. So there were a lot of people who knew each other online, many whom had never met in real space. And somebody suggested as a game, having people in the on the news group describe other people on the news group who they had never met. And it was really quite funny. I turned out to be 6 feet tall with, I think, gray hair, if I remember correctly. This was a long time ago when I didn't have gray hair. But that was a phenomenon. It was the same phenomenon, except they didn't have any physical reference at all. They were just creating a mental picture of somebody based on what they could judge about the personality. And I thought that was really sort of quite neat. But it's the same pattern. Yeah. Yeah, I was just reading a Wall Street Journal op-ed by Charles Murray, who's someone who I have somewhat mixed views. He's written some interesting books, and his most recent book is this one where he's arguing that America has really become two cultures, and that the sort of top half of the educational income stratum is more or less still living on the norms of 1950 or 1960, where it's assumed that men are expected to get married and stay married, that people are expected to have jobs and support themselves, and that if you don't, you're sort of a bum, and that's sort of, or a failure at least. But at the bottom, I don't say half, but the bottom chunk, that's broken down very badly, and so you have very high rates of single-parent homes, very high rates of people who are unemployed and aren't really trying to get employed, and so forth. And his solution is, one of the points he makes in the op-ed, is he doesn't think there's anything that either the Republicans or the Democrats could do in terms of legislation that would change this. That he thinks the original cause is largely the welfare state, but that the current cause is changes in cultural norms, not caused by that a long time. His first book was, called Losing Ground. It was a critique of sort of the war on poverty, an interesting book. But anyway, but he says that he thinks that what would change it would be a change in how people behave towards other people. That is, that he thinks that if you're, you know, if one of your friends has an adult son who's graduated from college but isn't working because he can't find any job he likes enough, you ought to treat him as a bum. You ought to make it clear that you think he's a freeloader, he's a worthless person, and, you know, that's his fault. And similarly, if somebody is working hard mowing your lawn for not a very high wage, you ought to treat them as an admirable person who's, you know, doing what people are supposed to do, kind of thing. And I don't know if he's right, but I thought it was an interesting point that he's really, because I think it may well be the case that a lot more depends on norms than on legal rules in functioning societies, although I think I understand them well enough to know sort of how the mechanics work or if there's any way of getting his effect. There's this book which I started and ought to finish someday by Stephenson called Diamond Age, which is a near future book in which you've got what seem to be essentially non-geographical nations defined by norms. So that one of these nations is the Neo-Victorians, referred to as Vickies. And Neo-Victorians believe in, you know, stable marriage, hard work, sort of a somewhat updated version of what we think of as Victorian age values. And the Victorian England was a very successful society in lots of ways. Not only conquers large parts of the world, but produces a lot of science and literature and other things we respect. And I don't remember what the rest of them were, but I just thought that was sort of an intriguing idea, and then in a sense Murray is saying that's really happening even if not formally. So, yeah.
And the reason you couldn't legislate those sorts of things is that they're intangible, I guess?
Yeah,
well,
and you
legislate, you know, marriage, obviously.
You can, yeah, you can legislate things that might affect it a little bit, so that if you imagine the question of, is it illegal for me to call you a bum? Well, it's not illegal, but it could be, and that would make it harder to do. You could certainly do things. You could do things like making welfare less generous. But I think Murray's argument is, 40 years ago, that might have prevented this change. But that, as it now is, welfare is less generous. Well, the unemployed men are going to live on their girlfriends, or they're going to sell drugs, or mug people, or, you know, find one or another way. Given that that's no longer assumed in the culture, that if you aren't a hard-working, honest guy with a good job, you probably are a failure and should be looked down on. Well, I should probably finish it then. It got depressing at a point like a quarter of the way in.
It helps to understand programming, though.
It might.
It is actually.
Yes. Yes, well, I understand programming, fortunately. But, yeah.
Seems to kind of ignore that theory. Seems to kind of ignore the fact that the lower echelon know, maybe just doesn't have the opportunity.
Yep. Well, the Murray op-ed at least argues that can't be the right answer. His point is that during times when unemployment in working class people was quite low, you still had an increasing shift in this direction. So you could, if you're curious, I just read this today on Google News. I don't know if you're familiar with it. That's what I mostly use to get news stories because it sort of picks up interesting stories from lots of different sources. And this was a Wall Street Journal one about something about economics not explaining the class divide or some phrase like that. And so it was a Murray op-ed, presumably in today's or yesterday's journal, if you want to read it, because he does give statistics. Whether he's right, I don't know. I don't entirely trust Murray. The reason I don't entirely trust, I know him not very well, but we were on a panel at one point, and he was saying things about a subject I knew something about, and he didn't. And he was acting as if he knew stuff he didn't know. I distrust bluffers. There are a lot in this world. So that's my negative element. On the other hand, as I say, I thought Losing Ground was a pretty persuasive book, and he does say interesting things, which is sort of pretty important and not all that common characteristic. And this book is an interesting thing, one. And back, he co-authored Bell Curve, which was a very controversial book, and I didn't read all of that either, but at least the part I read, he was making, it seems to me, a point which was a serious and interesting point, which was that America had become much more meritocratic over the last 100 years. That meritocratic, much more nearly the people at the top were there because they were able rather than because their parents were high status people. So that, for example, one of the points he made, which I suspect is correct, is that in 1910, the students at Harvard were not much smarter than the students at a state university. Because why were they at Harvard? Because their parents had money and status and so forth, whereas now the students at Harvard are quite a lot smarter than the students at the Random State University, that essentially we are sorting people by ability much more than we were then. And his view is, in many ways, this is a good thing, but it has two serious downsides. One of them is that you end up with a society where the people at the top correctly believe they're smarter than the people underneath them. And that that's sort of dangerous. That if you imagine a society where you discover that the guy with the gas station attendant is just as smart as you are, and you know, after you've told him how the world should be run, he points out that you're wrong, in some ways that's going to be a healthier society than the one where the guy who's wearing the suit wins all the arguments. I'm reminded of H.L. Mencken. I may have told the story before, but H.L. Mencken was a very prominent columnist, newspaper writer in the first half of the 20th century. Very good, too. I'm a great admirer of him. And in his diary, which was eventually published, he describes this incident where he's going to visit a friend who lives out in the countryside, and the friend sends his chauffeur to pick Mencken up at the railroad station, and the chauffeur is black and uneducated and smart. And Mencken says, you know, it was a really interesting conversation seeing what the world looked like from that person's perspective. And then he's visiting his friend again. He's looking forward to the drive with his chauffeur. But unfortunately, there's a white woman who's also a guest, and the chauffeur won't open his mouth when she's around. And that partly it impressed me about, because Mencken got accused of being a racist and various other things. And I would not shake the hand of the man who published his diary, because he was the one who pushed that idea. And it just isn't true if you read the damn thing. What's true is that he uses words like kikes and I don't know if he uses niggers, but rather than that, which were in common usage at the time. But if you look at his actual attitudes, here is a very famous man who takes every human being he meets as an equal until he finds something iron, so to speak. That is really is. So anyway, that's a long digression. But anyway, so one of the points in Bell Curve, and I didn't read the whole book, so I'm judging by the early part of it, is that this change has this potentially damaging effect. The other, however, is that it results in more assortive mating, that it is more likely that smart people marry smart people and dumb people marry dumb people, rather than the upwardly mobile middle-class guy marries the daughter of a rich man and she's not all that impressive, but he gets status that way, kind of thing.
What's that then?
Because it widens the bell curve. Bad is too strong. Why? It's dangerous. Because it means, if you think of a distribution of ability, a sort of mating tends to push it out. All right? In random mating, with a stable situation with perfectly random mating, which you didn't have before either, but imagine that. You've got, on the one hand, something pushing it out because somebody in the middle can only go higher or lower, but something pushing it in because someone who's out here probably made somebody here, and that gets you back in.
That depends on the assumption that the child of those...
It depends on the assumption that the relevant abilities are to a large degree heritable.
Right.
And I think there is overwhelming evidence that they are. That as far as I can tell, the serious studies of identical twins separated at birth and siblings of other sorts show that in a society like ours, something like half of the variance in IQ is explainable on straight genetic grounds. And that may be a debatable statement, but as far as I can tell, it's a debatable statement because a lot of people don't want to believe it. But there's been lots of different people who've done research on this and they've gotten roughly the same results.
I would argue that in the past, when males were controlling the mating market, they married females on the basis of their looks, largely. And looks essentially have very little, if anything, to do with intelligence. So essentially that was a randomizing factor.
Could be.
Moved away from that in the last...
Except that the other thing happening is that if you're a high-status male, you want a wife from a high-status family because they're your allies. And the high-status family is also likely to be able people. Yep.
Place where if you can have multiple wives, the first one you marry is generally for status to maintain,
right,
your social status, and the subsequent ones will be often. So the first one will be like for money, and the rest of them will be for lust, basically.
Yes.
So there's a lot of social mobility for women, but not if you're a poor man. You're just
Yes, that's interesting. There's this great story, which I think I've got from Altanuki, who was a judge in, I think, about the 9th or 10th century, of a judge who has married his first wife, who's rich, and is then using her money to get him additional wives. But every time that the first wife finds out about it, she makes such a fuss that he's got to divorce the additional wife. And the story is about the trick by which he manages to get in it. He manages to do it. Basically, he sets something up where his new, young, pretty wife shows up to talk to the other wife. Not saying, of course, that she's married to the husband, but with this false story about the thing she wants advice on and the other, and about how badly her husband is treating her. And the first wife says, "You think that's bad? You know, just let me tell you how badly the judge treats me." And then the judge is called in, and he's indignant. He says, "Not at all." Why? He says, "Just to prove that I'm not doing what you say, I will divorce with the binding triple divorce all women not in this house at the moment." And of course, it does not occur to her that the woman who's come to him is the one who he's. So anyway, so that's the story of exactly those lines. Yeah, yeah. No, there's a. But anyway, the effects of polygamy are also interesting because, of course, that also means that high-status males have more children. And if you have a society where being high-status is a result of being able, that would tend to breed up the average ability of that particular population. But on the other hand, my impression is that most, at least Islamic polygamous societies, most people weren't polygamous that you're talking about society. We usually think of it in terms of the high-status people. There's actually quite an interesting book called The Modern Egyptians, which was written in the 19th century by an Englishman who lived in Cairo for a while and obviously knew a lot of people. And his claim was that only a small fraction of people had more than one wife, and that for those families, the wife was a production good, not a consumption good. That those were families where both wives were, and that they weren't at the top, so to speak. But, of course, he wasn't associating with, you know, the people ruling the rich in Egypt at the time.
I read about it in History of Frank by Bishop, from the 800s, about the Merovingian king in France for the
Merovingian
king.
Yes.
So it's about abolition and also about how having it wasn't primogeniture, it was all the sons split up all their land equally.
Yeah, that's what happens to Charlemagne's empire, of course.
And then they kill their brothers to
Well, this is a version of the Ottoman system of instead of primogeniture, you have a civil war to decide which son is best.
Yeah, and it was just interesting
because
that was right before Charlemagne's father, who kicked out the
Merovingians,
right? Made a deal with the Pope.
Father or grandfather? Is it Charles Martel or Pepin who is the mayor of the palace, the last mayor of the palace to the Merovingians, who then takes over. Right. I'm not sure.
I just thought he teamed up with the Pope and agreed that he'd make marriage a sacrament and have you not.
Huh, that's interesting, yeah. Because the Merovingians did not have modern marriage institutions, but I didn't know.
It was the first Merovingian king that established, or that converted to Christianity.
Huh. Yeah. The, neat. But anyway, so no.
Why it shows up in the criminal law is because a man marries a woman, and initially his first wife is told the story that this woman that he's marrying is in fact a widow, and that he's essentially doing this as an act of charity to take her in. And then it turns out that in fact she has lied, and her husband is in fact alive. They just essentially staged a fake death so that she could in fact marry, and then now she's surreptitiously trying to support her desperately poor now ex-husband. Anyways, when that's found out,
but not legally ex.
Chaos ensues.
Yes.
Or the legal case ensues.
Yes.
There is a certain degree to which, depending on the society, you could take in these unattached females, which in Chinese society is essentially an unattached woman is a bad, bad thing. Like in Athens, they have to be, somebody has to be taken care of. Yeah. If you have a woman that has no family, and her husband is dead, then she needs to be married.
Well, I think that's one of the things that's happening in the very early Islamic history, that although there's a limit of four wives, it didn't apply to Muhammad himself. And my impression is that he was marrying a noticeable number of women who were basically either for political reasons or the widows of good Muslims who had died in battle, and somebody had to take care of them, and so he was. So that was a somewhat similar pattern. Yeah?
I just had a question about so you're talking about how to adjust the incentives for prosecution,
mm-hmm.
and how to strike the right balance, essentially by trading off the cost of failure to prosecute and the cost of abuse of prosecution.
Yeah.
So adding or subtracting from either of those. And then you contrast the Athenian law, and you say, which provided that the prosecutor could be guilty at least 20% of the jury to vote upon. I don't see how that's any different than the system you're
suggesting. I guess I would have said that first, that there are really two different issues. One of them is how hard should you try to sort of convict people, and one of them is how do we get you to convict the right people, and that I'm not sure if I understand the point you're making, but that basically if you think about it in terms of how large a budget should the prosecutor have, you say, well, if he has more money, we can protect more guilty people, there'll be less crime, that's a benefit, but it's costly, and it may also be costly because some people he may convict may be innocent. And you could imagine, even if you weren't worrying about convicting innocents, there's still some optimal level of prosecution, as it were. You don't want to catch 100% of the criminals. That's going to cost you too much to find the last guy, so to speak. But then there's the other question of how do we get the right incentive to get the right people? And one, the sort of obvious way, in a certain sense, is the Athenian approach. You punish people if you find out they've gotten the wrong person. Well, how do you do that? One way is they couldn't convict him, or they came very far from convicting him. A different way is to set it up so that rather than the legal system deciding he was the wrong person, the real world decides he's the wrong person, which is what my private deterrence mechanism is doing, if that makes sense. Is that maybe that doesn't answer your question. I didn't understand your question well enough.
I think I understand what you've written to say that we can strike the right balance by adjusting the costs.
One way, that's one thing, there are different balances. One thing you can do is to get the right reward for convicting people. And if you weren't worrying about convicting innocent people, that looks like all you have to do. You just say, all right, as we raise the reward, we convict a larger fraction of people, but we spend more resources doing it, maybe. So there's some optimum there, and I've got the math analyzed elsewhere. But then the other question is, how do we give differential incentives such that you convict, such that you prosecute and convict guilty people but not innocent people? And one mechanism, the mechanism that's sort of central in our system, I think, is you have trial rules which are designed to acquit the innocent and convict the guilty. And it's not clear to me how well that works, as I probably some of the people, some of my colleagues who look at these things in the real world, so to speak, would know more about it. But my suspicion is that it works pretty well for sort of competent defendants who can afford a lawyer, but that it probably works pretty badly for the sort of indigent defendant who's got a court-appointed lawyer and who doesn't know very much, and it's not clear the lawyer is really loyal to him. That I was mentioning before, back when I was in Chicago, one of my colleagues, Steve Schulhofer, told me he had an idea that he thought I might be interested in. And the idea was to have a voucher system for indigent defendants, defense attorneys. That instead of the present system, which is that by some mechanism, it varies place to place, in effect, the state government picks some. If you can't afford an attorney, the state government picks somebody to be an attorney, pays them some money, and he's your attorney. And in some places, that's through a public defender system where you've got sort of a body of attorneys you get full time. In some cases, it's an assigned one. In some cases, they're paid enough so that it's worth their doing. In some, it's really an obligation that they have to do. But the basic mechanism, pretty much in all, I think, of the U.S. Court systems, is that indigent felony defendants are entitled to an attorney, and the attorney is chosen for them by some part of the government, by the judge or by the public defender's office or whatever. And Steve argued, I thought very plausibly, that that's a pretty terrible way of doing it, because it means that the defense attorney is working for the same people as the prosecuting attorney, and it's not at all clear that he has the right incentives. That, you know, if, depending on how it's done, if he gets paid enough so that if he does little enough work, it's profitable, then he has an incentive to try to please whoever is appointing people. If he has lots of other interactions with the court system, what he may say to himself is, look, if the DA and the judge like me, that's going to be a professional advantage in my ordinary business. What do they like? They like not having too much trouble, having, you know, things go through with a lot of effort. I will always tell my people to accept a plea bargain. So you can see a lot of problems. And so Steve's idea, well, many people have complained about this system. And most of the complaints are they don't pay enough, which might be true, I don't know. But Steve's point was, given whatever they're willing to spend on this, it would be better if the defendant himself chose the attorney from those attorneys willing to do it at that price, because then you would have an incentive to try to do a good job. And so Steve and I wrote an article which was published arguing for this. And it was quite funny because Steve, I think, was considered sort of on the left end of the University of Chicago faculty. And I was considered by some definition of right on the right end. And the question was which of us had subverted the other into doing this joint article. And my claim was that question was answered when we gave a law and econ workshop on the paper. And I had the pleasure of hearing Steve Schulhofer lecture Judge Posner on the virtues of the free market. But of course, what was really going on was that we both agreed. That is to say, I think he was coming to it more from the standpoint of worrying about poor and powerless people being mistreated, which I disapprove of, although it's sort of, in a sense, not something I'm paying that much attention to. I was coming at it from the standpoint of socialist industries work badly. We ought to have something closer. It's not a full market. It's not your own money, but something more like a market, just as I think you have vouchers for schooling. Reached the same conclusion, jointly wrote the article. But it was pretty clear in the discussions that Posner pretty much explicitly took the position that the reason it was a bad, whether believes, I don't know, but it was a conversation, that the reason it was a bad proposal was it would make it harder to convict people. Because after all, the attorney was trying to get him acquitted. And that Posner thought that essentially in the relevant category of indigent defendants, everybody who was prosecuted was guilty. Wasn't always guilty of the crime that he was being prosecuted for, but the police essentially knew who the criminals were. I was reminded of the great line in Casablanca, for those of you who know the movie, round up the usual suspects. All right.
Okay, so I think I understand, yep. What I understand is that talking about altering the incentives.
That's right.
And I think,
And about looking at the incentives of different ways of running a legal system.
I think the Athenians did the same thing, essentially their 20%.
They're doing it by a penalty, right?
Right. And I think I actually read into what you said as drawing a contrast, but I don't think that's
what okay. But if you think about, if you think not about that, but the 18th century English system, that's in a way doing the same thing, but it's a totally different way. That assuming I'm right, and maybe I'm not, but assuming the criminals know each other, then that's a system where you don't get your payoff if you convict the wrong guy, not because the legal system doesn't give you a payoff, but because your incentive is deterrence, you don't get the deterrence. Yeah.
Well, so I was wondering about the same sort of thing in the office system section. You said there are essentially two incentives at work. There's the incentive of the, you know, the people in general who take the cost of trying to offset someone. So their incentive is to get the conviction correct. And then there's the incentive by someone who maybe it's a political rival who would then want to just
fall. Yes.
And I was wondering how those, because your paragraph is very short.
Yeah.
Pretty much these two incentives exist. I was wondering how they interact in any way, shape, or form.
I don't know. It's going to have to depend partly on how easily other people can figure out what's going on, right?
Mm-hmm.
Again, the information costs are going to be important. It's not as if I've really studied, and it would be really interesting to sort of, if you had detailed narratives of societies of that sort and where it worked and where it didn't work,
mm-hmm.
And so forth, because you can certainly see ugly possibilities.
Right. Well, I was wondering about the Amish.
Yeah.
They seem like this might be...
Notice that in the case of the Amish, at least in principle, it takes a unanimous vote to ostracize somebody.
Oh, interesting.
That, as far as I can tell, all verdicts only apply if nobody votes against them. Now, one suspects that in practice there's going to be a good deal of social pressure, that you trust the clergy, and if they say you should do it. But in principle, you know, there's this meeting twice a year before they have communion in which they're discussing the current interpretation of the ordinum. And supposedly you can't have communion until everybody agrees. That's at least the theory of it, as it's described.
Then the other flip side is that...
Yep.
So it's the same idea with what I was bringing up my paper.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the idea being that instead of an officism imposed on someone as a conviction,
yes.
It's a voluntary act.
Yes.
How would...
Voluntary by the person who's ostracized?
Right. Because it's essentially a cost borne by you and having to travel, but then there's the benefit of then being able to live in an area where you're not having to deal with anybody.
Ah, so you're considering the case where... I'm not getting along with my neighbors, and so I leave.
Right.
Right. And you can argue that that has attractive features from several standpoints. It gives my neighbors a incentive not to be nasty to me unless I'm really a bad person, because they're going to lose the opportunity to deal with me. I wonder, I was thinking in sort of a context with the same logic with much smaller stakes. If you think about social organizations, if you think about a club at a college or something, and where, on the one hand, in order for the club to work, they got to have members. But some members can be really disruptive. And so when somebody is a problem, is the response to other people to say, let's just be mean to him and we'll drive him away? Or is the response to say, well, he's a problem, we've got to keep people, so how can we understand him? And maybe we can persuade him to behave better and so forth. That's sort of a much more familiar case that probably all of us in some sense have observed versions of, even though it's a much lower stakes game than the one you're describing. Yeah. But no, I mean, in principle, I suppose I'd like to fill out all the chapters with lots more stuff. Part of the reason I'm teaching the class is to get more ideas, but I'm never going to cover everything you could say about this stuff. I mean, it's only one book, not a literature. Be nice to know more about how ostracism works. And maybe somewhere there's a book about ostracism, about societies that use it. It'd be nice if it is. Let's see. Other comments? No. I was thinking with regard to the private deterrence that there are really sort of analogous contexts in not quite legal situations. If you think about a college enforcing its rules, or about a shopping mall, right? If you think about it, Westgate Mall is really the free market equivalent of a town. That is, it belongs to somebody. It's private property. the owners, presumably, they provide parking. They presumably make rules. They will probably mostly rules for the stores. They decide. They can say, well, we need this kind of store. It'll pull in more people. We don't need that kind of store. It makes the ambiance look bad kind of thing. So they can do a lot of things that you could imagine being done by zoning and regulation, but they're just doing it through property rights and exchange. And one of the things they presumably do is have their own security. And I presume, I don't know a lot about how they're run, that they have an incentive, if you imagine, say, a shopper who's drunk, that they've got an incentive on the one hand to try to avoid his sort of making it an unpleasant place. But assuming he isn't drunk all the time, they'd like him to come back and buy stuff when he's sober. So there's a certain sense in which their incentive to discriminate among people, to distinguish between the guy who basically is a bum, who's just a nuisance, so they don't want to have around, and the person who took one too many, but is basically a reasonable person, is much stronger than that of an ordinary police force. So I was thinking that in a way, a different version of the private deterrence thing is any situation in which the organization running the law enforcement somehow gets a revenue from that, from the society's enforcing on it running, working well. So if you imagine a case where the law enforcement is run by the proprietor of a proprietary community, whether it's a housing development or an apartment building or a shopping mall, at least the people at the top have an incentive to try to make it the kind of place that the customers want to be in. There's, we're meant to talk about another about science fiction. There's another science fiction book which is quite interesting on this, which is called Oath of Fealty by Niven and Pornell, who were both pretty... They're both pretty good writers, but as a team, they can sometimes are very good. And that the basic story there is that at some point in the not very distant future, there's been a riot in Los Angeles which has trashed a noticeable chunk of the city. And an international corporation makes a deal with the city. And the deal is that they can build an arcology, essentially a city-sized building, which will belong to them. They will enforce the rules within it. And they will pay a fixed sum, essentially, in lieu of taxes to the city of Los Angeles in order to have these rights. So that they're doing something which is, in effect, like a private proprietary state inside an ordinary state. And it's not completely absurd. If you think about the Jewish communities in the Middle Ages, they were somewhat like that in that they were enforcing their own rules and paying some fixed sum in taxes. And there are various proposals now. My older son is involved with one where the government of Honduras apparently is willing to let foreign entrepreneurs essentially take a chunk of land in Honduras and enforce their own rules within it. The idea is to make sort of a new world Hong Kong kind of effect. It's Peter Thiel's one involved in the project and various other people. And don't know if it'll work or not, but in the science fiction version, it's quite neat. But it's made clear that in the arcology, I forget what they call it, if their policemen find you wandering around the arcology drunk, they don't lock you up. They figure out where your apartment is and they help you get to your apartment. And, you know, they put you to bed more or less and let you sleep it over. And in general, that the interaction between the security and the residents is much more seeing the security as their servants, so to speak, as working for them than in the ordinary case. And the neat thing, which really justifies the title, the thing I thought was particularly interesting, is there's a fake terrorist attack by some environmentalists who for some reason think the arcology is bad. And they appear to be carrying boxes of dynamite towards a pipe bringing in, I think, hydrogen, which is part of the powering system that the arcology uses, where if it blows up, it will cause an enormous amount of damage and kill a lot of people. And the arcology has various defenses, but none of the... They're quite sophisticated fake terrorists who are trying to make a point. The defenses don't work. And the last gasp defense is a lethal gas. So the guy who's in charge, who is a sort of second in charge, because the person who runs the arcology is off somewhere, has to make the decision, and he gasses the attackers and kills several of them, one of whom is the daughter of a powerful Los Angeles politician. He is arrested and charged with murder. A reporter who is covering this thing goes to the head of the arcology and says, I won't tell if you'll let me watch it and cover the story. And he says, won't tell what? that you're planning to break him out. How do you know that we're planning to break him out of the prison? Because all of your people expect you to. And the point of it, that's why with the fielding, the point is that given that this private organization is filling the functions of a state, it becomes the focus of the same emotions. And therefore, from the standpoint of the people in the arcology, he isn't somebody who unfortunately is accused of a crime he's not guilty of. He's a man who put himself in danger defending them. He's now a prisoner of war of the enemy who attacked them from their standpoint. That is made very clear that the people, Todos Santos, that's the name of the, I think, of the arcology, and I forget what the term is, but that the people from the arcology don't think of themselves as Los Angeles inhabitants. They think of themselves essentially as inhabitants of a different state. And they look different. They move differently. They can recognize each other. So it's quite an interesting and I thought quite sophisticated story. They say it's called Oath of Fealty. But that was an interesting point. But part of the point really was that at least in that context, the incentives of the enforcement people were right because they were working with people who were collecting rent. And if you make it a place where people don't want to live, you aren't going to collect any rent. Essentially, that was the ultimate logic of the system, which was interesting.
Yeah.
Looking at, even if I'm not entirely convinced that free market could do all the things that we think are essential to a legal system.
Yep.
Taking one example might be it won't stop certain kinds of bias or prejudice. An example I might give would be it took legislation to require white employers to not discriminate on the basis of race.
When you say essential to a legal system, are you suggesting that in the 19th century the U.S. did not have a legal system? When there were no rules against such discrimination?
I'm saying there were no such rules. There are no rules against such discrimination.
But what I'm saying is that what you're really saying is not that you wouldn't have a functioning legal system, but that you think the legal system would not do some things you would like a legal system to do.
I'm saying
it's a much weaker...
No, I'm right. saying that the market won't achieve all the things that we want.
That you want in a legal system. Obviously,
society
doesn't want anything. Society doesn't exist. Obviously, as of not very long ago, many people didn't want those things in the legal system. And what things people want in a legal system is still a matter of dispute. And some people think legal systems should do some things. People think the legal system ought to force insurance to cover contraception, and some don't, to take a recent dispute.
I agree that my argument depends on some things being intrinsic to a properly functioning legal system. I do agree that.
Is not arresting and punishing people for doing things that harm nobody else intrinsic to a properly functioning legal system?
I think it is.
Then we don't have a properly functioning legal system, do we?
I agree that it's not perfect. Yeah.
So therefore, what you're saying is not that the alternative can't give a functioning legal system, but it is a legal system that will in some ways be worse than the present one by your values, and in some ways better. That sounds plausible enough.
Yeah, that's probably true.
I think the basic point of that would be that in law school, they teach us that the backing behind law is this thing called public policy, and the idea being that public policy tends to be something that, on an individual basis, the free market will not tend towards, but if you were to take a step back and say, what would be the best thing for the whole nation, that's what...
Yeah, that's the claim, but there are two different problems here. One of them is, for any particular policy, whether it's true, because if you take the one that you're thinking about, one possible result of rules against racial discrimination in employment may be to make it harder for blacks to be hired because people are saying, when I first hire somebody, I don't know if I'm going to want to fire him or not. If it's much easier to sue somebody for firing you than for not hiring you, because there's a big pool of people you can hire and a much smaller pool of people who are working for you. So it might turn out to be the case that these rules actually have the opposite of the desired effect. Right?
No, I don't see that.
Suppose it's the case, and I do not have no evidence on whether it is or is not. Imagine we could run two parallel worlds, one with and one without employment discrimination rules. All right. Suppose you observed, to your surprise, that the one with those rules, the average wage of blacks was lower than one without it 50 years later. One possible explanation of that, what might be happening, is that preventing employers from discriminating in who they hire is very hard, because the employer, after all, has got to judge people on a bunch of different characteristics. You don't have enough bureaucrats or whatever to watch every employer in the country and say, how did you decide who to hire? On the other hand, once you hire somebody, if you fire him and there are laws against discrimination, he may well be in a position to sue you and make that expensive. Does that sound like a plausible story? If that's the case, you will then be reluctant to hire people of categories that you're not allowed to discriminate against for fear that if they turn out badly, you won't be able to fire them. So that along similar lines, I've seen it argued that the very high youth unemployment rate in Europe is a result of legal rules with a lot of job security. That basically, it is very hard for employers to fire people, and they are therefore very reluctant to hire new workers who they can't yet evaluate. I'm not sure that's right, but it's not implausible. So all I'm saying is that one question, one level of question is, for any such policy, is it really as a good policy as people claim? And of course, people who support things are going to see the good things about it. Second question, sort of the next level up and more interesting one to me, are there mechanisms such that the policies the state enforces will be the good ones? That after all, we don't have a benevolent philosopher king sort of running in Congress. So you have some political mechanism which generate laws. Is there a good reason to expect them to generate good laws? And the argument that I would make, if you're sufficiently curious, I gave a talk in Boise a few days ago, and the recording is up on my webpage discussing some of these issues, is that the private mechanism for generating law, which is a radical and weird idea, but one that I've been interested in for a long time, has more of a tendency to generate good law than the political mechanisms do. And from that standpoint, it's an advantage, not a disadvantage. And that would be a long discussion. I'd say, if you're curious, if you're sufficiently curious, I could point you at where I've made the argument. But in any case, but I think it's almost certainly the case that any system at all is going to produce some outcomes that almost everybody's truth. That not outcomes that everybody's truth. Oh, for almost everybody in the society, there'll be at least one feature of the legal system that he disapproves of. Different features for different people. And some people will say, anti-discrimination law is one of the things I don't like. My father resigned from the ACLU over either fair housing or fair employment law because he thought that the ACLU used to be in freedom and now was in favor of freedom and now was against it, because it was saying that it was rejecting freedom of contract. It was saying it's not up to the employer to decide who he wants to associate with. He's got to do it on the basis the state says. Whereas other people would take your position and say, no, I would resign from the ACLU if they didn't support those positions. So, but anyway. But as I said, to me at least, the more interesting question is not the specific issue. The more interesting question, and I think it was a higher level, what mechanisms could be expected to generate good law? Why is it in the interest of Congress, or isn't it, of congressmen to vote for laws that make the people under them better off and against laws that make them worse off? And there are cases where I think it is provable that it isn't. And this, my standard example of this is tariffs. That the economics of foreign trade was worked out in the early 19th century by David Ricardo. We've known it ever since. That's we being people seriously interested in the field. It is reasonably clear that in all, with some narrow exceptions, that a country that imposes the tariff makes its population worse off. Those narrow exceptions do not fit the industries that actually get tariff protection. And yet, from Ricardo's time to now, there have been only a very small number of examples of societies that didn't have tariffs. England in the 19th century and Hong Kong in the 20th, both very successful societies that happens. I think there are plausible economic explanations of why it's politically profitable to pass a tariff, even though it makes the population worse off. And if that's right, then that would be one example that the mechanism we now have can't be relied on to make good law. It might still make better law than some alternative.
Moving down to the lower question, yes, that you proposed, I would at least say that as a purely descriptive situation, most people in today's society, I think, would say that the principles of bias and anti-discrimination laws are good. We achieve the state we have now only by legislation, not by free market principles.
Well, I think the answer is because we don't have the parallel worlds, we don't know. That is to say...
Well, we have a world that just before...
I understand, but we... Of course, but then the other question is, how are things changing? Whether social attitudes were changing for other reasons. That after all, we do have a series of other examples, not parallel worlds, but earlier histories, where you had, just as you have a whole lot of relatively uneducated poor blacks from the South coming up into the northern cities in the early 20th century, which is a context which is going to make people think poorly of them. You have the same pattern occurring with the Irish, with the Eastern European Jews, with the Poles. You had over the late 19th and early 20th century repeated cases where you've got a mass of immigrants coming in where the people already there say, look what filthy, uneducated, criminal people these are. We don't want to have anything to do with them. Where without anti-discrimination law, over a period of time, those attitudes broke down and those people get absorbed. So that's some evidence that even without the law, things change. And then I don't know how you would find out whether they would have changed as fast, faster, or slower if you had not had those laws. I think it's Tom Sowell who comments somewhere that he had the good fortune to go to college after discrimination and before anti-discrimination laws. Or maybe they had before affirmative action. With the result that he's black, and with the result that he didn't have to worry about people saying, the reason he got to go to college such and such is that he's black and they're favoring them. And by his account, he did not, in fact, encounter discrimination. So, yeah.
But would you agree that a relatively swift and sudden changing cultural attitudes right around the time of anti-discrimination laws would be indicative that they were effective?
If you could, what you'd need to know is which happens first.
Right.
Because it could be that the change caused the laws, or it could be the laws caused the change. And, I just don't know enough about it. Sowell's got a book, Ethnic America, which is the one where he discusses all these other immigrations, and where he argues that there's a lot of parallelism between the experiences, not of blacks in the South, but of blacks from the South coming up to the North. That paralleled the migrations from Europe and had a lot of the same patterns. I gather that when Eastern European Jews were a new group, they were supposed to be low IQ, uneducated, all of the same sorts of things. And nonetheless, that ceases to be true. And Sowell points out somewhere, I think it's in Latin America, that West Indian immigrants to the U.S. do quite well. His argument is that the real reason that American blacks do badly is cultural features of black culture that are themselves a result of Southern slavery rather than existing discrimination. And the West Indians are an example, a counterexample. And his claim, at least, I don't know if it's right, is that West Indian slavery was much more like a peasant system where the slave was running his own life and had to do a certain amount of work for the master, and much less sort of a perverse socialist system in a sense in which the master is running the slave's life and therefore taught different lessons. Yeah.
Can we argue though that if the government does not get involved, they might be discriminating?
Yeah.
And they just sort of sit on it and go to the legislature. But it's almost as if they're condoning the behavior and society will continue to condone the behavior.
Maybe, except you really want to say that everything that is not illegal is good?
No.
I don't know if you've ever read The Once and Future King, but the sign over the anthill, everything that's not forbidden is compulsory. But notice, by the way, that you're sort of assuming that government intervention is necessarily on the good side. But in fact, the real history of discrimination is that it was largely state-enforced. That one of the things, I remember reading an article about, that around 1900-ish, there were private firms in the South that were in the business of finding places where black workers were wanted and treated reasonably well, and places of the opposite sort, and putting them together and helping the black workers in places where they were very badly off migrate. This is mostly within the South, the places that were better. And those firms were shut down by state action.
Interracial marriage was shut down by state action. It used to be quite common in the early colonies, and then the state laws in Virginia, yep, those other states, at least they were banning interracial marriage as of 1710, yep, 1720.
Yeah. So, in a sense, the fact that you have the state involved in making laws doesn't tell you if they'll make good laws or bad laws. The answer almost certainly is it'll do both. And again, finding a particular area where you think their law was right, even if you're correct, doesn't really answer the question of whether this is a better way of generating laws than, say, a feud system, to take one example, or any of all of the other possible ways of doing it.
I think it would be a good way of sort of spreading the message, though. I mean, even if the law is not effective, what is
maybe, but think about affirmative action. Isn't the message affirmative action spreads blacks are inferior? Look, the only way to get into Congress is if we weight the scale. And more seriously, isn't the message that this particular black person who graduated from Harvard, we can't assume is as good as Harvard graduates in general? He might be, but who knows? So in that sense, it's a perverse message.
Well, I think part of it is just equalizing the playing field, and that, you could argue that someone, there are two people that have the exact same intelligence level,
yeah,
and they just haven't had the same opportunities, and it has nothing to do.
You could certainly make that argument. But of course, to the extent that intelligence is what really ends up mattering, that is, in some cases you might say they have the same innate level, but now one of them is permanently stupider because he got bad nutrition or whatever. But suppose it's the case that they have the same innate level and that given the opportunities they can both perform well. Surely there is an incentive for a college that's currently in the second rank and wants to be in the first rank to search those people out, because they're the people not being accepted by the first. I was thinking about this in an entirely different context, which was when my daughter was applying to college, and she was homeschooled. And that's a real problem if you're applying to college, because you don't have the credentials they want. It's not so much that they're prejudiced against homeschooled students. They don't know how to tell if they're any good. They've got SAT exams, but that's all they've got, basically. And there was one college where we did not have any advantage in terms of, alumni and the family kind of thing, which accepted her. And they, as far as I could tell, were trying to get homeschool students. Because that, I may have told the story before, I don't know, but basically, this was St. Olaf. And St. Olaf is a good but not quite top-ranked school. And when we got an email after she'd applied saying, our deadline for application is the end of December, but we think you should know that we have merit scholarships for which the deadline is the end of November, and we have found homeschool students are sometimes very well qualified. And they offered her money and admitted her. She didn't end up going there. And it's my conjecture of what was going on was that St. Olaf, like Oberlin, has a professional level music program. They are the two liberal arts colleges of which that's true. Oberlin, on what I can tell, has been gradually sliding down for 20 years. And my conjecture was that St. Olaf wants to replace Oberlin. They saw that the problem in doing that is that the really good students want to go to the really good schools, but you need really good students to become a really good school. And they sensibly said, where is there a pool that our competitors are missing? Aha, homeschool students, some of them are really good, not all of them, but they don't have to all be, and because other schools are missing the good ones because they can't recognize them, if we focus on them, we can do better. That's my theory. I can't prove it's true, but anyway, that would be sort of a counter-argument of how the private mechanism gives some people an incentive to spot those people. And similarly, if able blacks are being discriminated against in employment, then you can make a lot of money by having a firm that specializes in hiring blacks, because you'd be able to get better people at the price. Anyway, long discussion. Right, and we're out of time. Thank you.